Hi, thanks for coming. I have to confess at the outset that I need to apologize. And I feel like a bit of an imposter at a labor-sponsored event because I spend much more time studying the bourgeoisie than I do studying the proletariat. So, but I'll try to talk some about labor at the end of this. But I'm going to talk about a couple of very interesting things that happened because of the Sanders campaign. And there are at least two very fascinating things that the campaign last year did, and it really seems like a very long time ago that that all happened under Trump time. Sanders revealed a constituency for social democratic politics that was surprisingly large and energetic, and I'm totally surprised to many of us who have been studying American politics for a very long time. And it also opened up some very promising fissures in the neoliberalized Democratic Party and in the organized labor itself. A few words on each of these surprises. First, the constituency for social democratic politics. No, Sanders is not a socialist, a point that leftists love to make, and still do. But by contemporary standards, to talk in terms of collectivity, of solidarity, and to propose universal programs like Medicare for All and free public college tuition, that seems positively bullshitted by the standard of several decades. And the enthusiasm for his campaign, which seemingly came out of nowhere, especially among younger people, was really just stunning, highly impressive, and inspiring. I wrote a piece for Harper's Magazine in the summer of 2015, which was published in the early fall, about Hillary Clinton. And I got in the habit of calling her Hillary to distinguish her from her husband, so I refer to Hillary when I'm drinking. But it's just, I don't mean to be disrespectful to her, but I just got into the habit, so I continued it. But when I was writing that, it was nearly 100% certain that she was going to be the nominee of the Democratic Party. And any challenges to that would be fleeting and rapidly disposed of. The conventional wisdom at the time also, which I admit I subscribe to, was that Jeb Bush would be the Republican nominee. So that U.S. politics, at least at the presidential level, has settled into some kind of dynastic mode appropriate for an imperium in decline. Obviously, that didn't work on the Republican side. Jeb Bush, accurately and fatally dubbed as low energy by the eventual nominee and now our appalling president, Jeb crashed and burned. Hillary would make it to the nomination, but not uneventfully. But there were plenty of divisions within the Democratic Party which got quite hostile and quite passionate during the campaign. Sanders, having revealed the social democratic constituency within the Democratic Party and also outside of it, smoked out the true thinking of so many establishment Democrats. They used to say that some of the things they thought that Sanders was campaigning on were admirable goals, but we just weren't ready for them yet. But then they openly came out against them. Along these lines, I spent a few years on a thing called a Kabbalist, an email discussion list for liberal pundits. I was invited on for ideological diversity, but it soon came clear that things are not working out so well. I joined with the hope that maybe I could make common cause with some of these folks. I was feeling generous, and we're all on the same side, want the same goals, even if we differ on some of the specifics. But it was quickly revealed to me how hostile to the left these liberals are. Things really came to a head when I disclosed the Harper's Magazine commission to write that critique of Hillary. They're very deeply hostile to the whole idea of writing anything critical of her. By doing so, I was only enabling Ted Cruz, because the only reason you could be against Hillary was that you were a Republican and or a misogynist. I repeatedly asked them to make a case for her, but none of them, a crew of people, were professional pundits, journalists, academics, people who gave their opinions for a living. None of them really could or would give a principled or vigorous defense of Hillary's candidacy. One of them, Rebecca Traister, who wrote a book about Hillary in 2008, or more precisely, a book about her feelings about Hillary, told me to go to a library, look it up, and don't bother her with questions. Freudian that I am, I thought this explicitly defensive reaction was a sign of unconscious doubt, but those defenses were unbreachable. But in my 2 or 3 years on that catalyst, I came to understand the ideology of contemporary liberalism in a way I'd never had before, whatever contemporary liberalism is. They believe then, and I presume still do, that the right is so powerful, so institutionally and ideologically dominant, that all those left of center could do was to fight defensive battles to preserve the gains of previous decades. And by making demands for new programs, such as Sanders was doing, only exposed existing programs, like Obamacare, to repeal by this very powerful and dominant right. I never understood the logic of this. It seemed to me that asking for 150% of what you want is the only way ever to get 75% of it, but they never bought that line. Certainly the right has been pursuing this strategy with great success, at least since the 1970s, intransigent, demanding, and never giving up with any defeat. But the reason the right did that, and still does, is because they actually have a set of beliefs, as crazy as they are, an actual political philosophy. It's hard to figure out what liberalism actually stands for today. In response to one of my frequent taunts on this subject, on this list, Paul Starr, Princeton professor and one of the founders of the American Prospect, a prominent liberal journal, sent me an encyclopedia article he'd just written on the topic of liberalism. It's a massive mush that begins with this sentence and doesn't get any better. Liberalism stands for a belief in an equal right to freedom and dignity advanced by a government of constitutionally restrained powers. That's really inspiring, isn't it? Nothing in there about the ownership and distribution of resources and power, just some abstract talk about this. Sanders, by getting materialist, but made them nervous. Their fear and envy of the right was striking, but with no socialist threat to water down or co-opt, they had no real ideas of their own, something that Hillary's campaign made very, very clear. Now, capitalists are intellectuals of a sort. More practical politicians were blunter in their response to Sanders' rude injection of a strand of social democracy into American political discourse. Representative John Lewis, inevitably described as a civil rights icon, dismissed Sanders' proposal by saying, "No one gets anything for free in America," which is true, I guess. But that usually goes unsaid. Sanders forced establishment Dems like him to say it out loud. In one of the debates, responding to Bernie's holding up Danish social democracy as something of a model, Hillary said, made the irrefutable point that the U.S. is not Denmark. She also said that getting things for free, of course they're not free because you have to pay taxes, but they may be free at the point of service, but getting things for free is bad because, as she said, you need skin in the game. It's not a game, but I'd rather keep my own skin, thank you. What provoked panic among mainstream Dems was that Bernie's campaign made boldly, screamingly apparent, something that was always there. The party's loyalty to independence in Wall Street in particular, and business in general, really dominates the party's politics. The party's funders don't like expanding social programs. If you give the masses something, they'll only want more, and we can't have that. Better to keep them nervous and grateful for the few crumbs they're allowed. The fundamental contradiction of the Democratic Party, what makes them so often seem weak and vacillating, is that it's a party of capital that has to pretend for electoral reasons that it's not. Bernie's campaign shone a spotlight on that contradiction. For a moment, it looks like things were getting away from the party's leaders, but ultimately, Clintonian organization and money prevailed. But just barely, and certainly didn't prevail in November. Funnily enough, in her preposterously long and dull new book, What Happened, and there's no question mark there, Hillary actually says this: Bernie proved again that it's important to set lofty goals that people can organize around and dream about, even if it takes generations to achieve them. Rejecting a generation of neoliberal orthodoxy, which she helped design, by the way. You know, when I started doing my Hillary research, I didn't appreciate how active a participant she was in devising this new Democrat ideology that her husband made famous, but she is very much a part of it, very much a partner with him. So rejecting a generation of that ideology, she continued, Democrats should reevaluate a lot of our assumptions about which policies are politically viable. These trends make universal programs even more appealing than we previously thought. I mean programs like Social Security and Medicare, which benefit every American, as opposed to Medicaid, food stamps, and other initiatives targeted to the poor. Targeted programs may be more efficient and progressive, which is why in primaries I criticized Bernie's Free College for All plan as providing wasteful taxpayer giveaways to rich kids. But it's precisely because they don't benefit everyone that targeted programs are so easily stigmatized and demagogued. Democrats should redouble our efforts to develop bold, creative ideas that offer broad-based benefits for the whole country. I don't know when Democrats have ever done that, at least in the last 40 years, but that's what she said. And I don't believe she means it. I'll take it. That's a pretty good statement there. And now on to the assigned topic. I'm afraid there's not as much as I would like to be able to describe about Labor's role in the Sanders campaign. It's just really not all that enormous. But it did open up a fissure in organized labor, like the one it opened up within the Democratic Party. One that was always there, but never so visible. That is between the Social Democratic and neoliberal unions. During the campaign, I asked a friend who's pretty high up in the Service Employees and Pension Union why they endorsed Hillary so early in the campaign. He countered that it wasn't really that early at all, and that if anything, it was too late. I asked him why they didn't at least hold back the endorsement in the hope of getting some pledges from her about what she might do for labor if she won. But no, he said, it was too late. That made no political sense to me at all. But this is how they think within SEIU. They might have been afraid of Clinton-esque vengeance for their late endorsement. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, who managed Hillary's 2007 campaign, which she announced before she was even a resident of New York State, de Blasio was coy about endorsing her, although no one ever doubted for a minute that he eventually would. But his punishment was that he wasn't allowed to appear with her on the campaign trail. There's a pretty amusing picture of him in Des Moines, Iowa, trudging across the snow-lined streets in, I believe, February, knocking on doors instead of making glorious campaign appearances with the presumptive nominee. De Blasio also got a crappy time slot for his speech during a Democratic convention. But still, he didn't have that much to bring to the table. New York was going to vote for the Democrat, whoever the nominee was. So de Blasio endorsement was perhaps not all that important. But this SEIU did have something to bring to the table. Money, organization, and audience to do a lot of knocking on doors and making phone calls. But it was more than political expediency that drove SEIU's thinking. There are serious ideological affinities between the union and Hillary's campaign. In fact, a whole neoliberal labor caucus developed at the 2016 Democratic Convention. Which Andrew Tillett Sachs wrote about in a piece in Jacobin about a year ago. Historically, unions had caucused as a whole at the Democratic Convention to present some kind of united front at the party's meeting. And this time, four unions, SEIU, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, and the two teachers' unions, the American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association, these four were among Hillary's biggest labor supporters. They all caucused separately and created some kind of neoliberal caucus that was separate from the other unions. During the campaign, I asked AFT President Randy Weingarten what she made of Hillary. She's very active on Twitter. She spends too much time on Twitter, but you know, if you tweeted her, she'll answer you. So I did. So I asked her what she made of Hillary's involvement in a very anti-union campaign for teacher competency tests when she was the First Lady of Arkansas. It was quite ugly, since many of those teachers whose competence was being called in question were black women. Weingarten responded that didn't matter to her at all. It's just that Hillary listened to her and her issues. Of the four of these unions, SEIU, especially under its former president, Eddie Stern, has been the most engaged in trying to craft a collaborative strategy with employers. They don't view the role of labor as being antagonistic to employers. It's one of helping them do better and compete better. Although I'm not sure if the employers are very interested in this partnership. Stern's successor, Mary Kay Henry, isn't as egregious as he was, but she's still very much into partnerships. Regardless of that, the first, second, third, and sixth largest unions in the U.S. quite consciously caucus separately from the rest of the labor movement to show their fealty to Hillary. I shouldn't be this gloomy, though. Several unions did endorse Bernie, including the communications workers, whose former president, Larry Cohen, is now head of Our Revolution, descendant of the Sanders campaign, which is doing, I'm not quite sure what, but trying to work on issues and campaigns. Along with the CWA, we're the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, the Postal Workers Union, a few others. Altogether, the Bernie unions have about 1.7 million members, which is less than a quarter of the neoliberal caucus does. About 100 union locals also endorsed the Sanders campaign. And there was a lot of resentment among the locals and among rank and filers about the Hillary endorsements among the more conservative unions. But the bulk of the labor movement remains firmly wedded to the establishment Democrats. And I'm not even sure that that Cohen and Our Revolution would really do anything to challenge the party in any significant way. The unions that endorse Sanders have formed a Labor for Our Revolution group. They have spoken in defense of immigrants and aim to work in political campaigns for congenial candidates, but it's still an open question how much they can or will do. It's sad, though, how absent the AFL-CIO is in current politics. It's a weak federation of member unions, yes, and the unions are mostly jealous of ceding their individual power to a national organization like the AFL-CIO. So there's only so much it can do. But a number of unions, especially the building trades, the kind of organizations who, as the joke goes, wouldn't mind building internment camps as long as it was done with union labor, they flirted with Trump, hoping to get something out of this non-existent infrastructure program. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka was very slow to leave a Trump Manufacturing Advisory Board, coming in behind the CEO of Merck and even the CEO of Under Armour, an actual Trump supporter, in resigning. After resigning, Trumka disclosed that many people around Trump are racists and Wall Streeters, people you really just can't work with. For some reason, it took him 8 months of a Trump presidency to figure this out. So all in all, the Sanders campaign opened up some promising fissures in the Democratic Party and organized labor. The young people with Bernie-esque politics now running for local office across the country. That's promising, but of course the risk is always that they're going to get chewed up by the party. Those aim to march through the institutions often find the institutions marching through them. But something interesting is going on, and I haven't even mentioned the explosive growth in membership in the Democratic Socialists of America. I'm less enthused by the labor movement, which still seems in the grip of political torpor and membership decline, and a forthcoming Supreme Court decision could well deal a hammer blow to the Public Employees Union. But we'll see if anything our revolution and its labor allies can do from here. It'll be nice if they do something lively from here, but I have my doubts. But still, the heritage of the Sanders campaign still exercises an influence over activism, thinking, and the whole younger cohort is very enthusiastically getting into politics. So it's a good heritage, but we have a lot to cope with.